from the grub-infested studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another Save the Roses episode of Chemical-Free Horticultural Hijinks, You Bet Your Garden. Are beetle grubs destroying your lawn? Are adult beetles ravaging your roses? I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'll tell you how to control both pests with the newest BT on the block. Otherwise, it's a fabulous phone call show. Yeah, we're going to take your telecommunicated questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and fantastically fragile felicitations. So keep your ears right here. It's all coming up faster than you having a beetle-free season right after this.
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
From the star-studded studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another celestial hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks, You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and in this week's In the News, we present a story by Stephanie Vermillion that appeared on the National Geographic website on March 26th, which we are calling the Parade of Planets. And we quote, spring is known as galaxy season. Here's what to find this month, plus when and where to look. The pre-dawn planet parade. An exceptional planet parade will adorn the sky for about half an hour before the sun rises from April 16th to the 23rd. Mercury, Mars, and Saturn will appear in a tight cluster just above the eastern horizon. The most striking views come between April 18th and 20th, when the planets appear closest together. Look for a viewpoint with unobstructed views across the eastern horizon, such as a large lake. Peak stargazing conditions. The Milky Way core is increasingly visible in pre-dawn hours. To see it, head out around the new moon on April 17th. One of the month's best nights for stargazing. There's no lunar glare, so sights like the Milky Way's luminous center, packed with millions of stars, become visible. Moon, Pleiades, and Venus conjunction. After sunset on April 18th and 19th, the crescent moon, Venus, and the Pleiades star cluster will loosely line up above the western horizon, visible for around 2 or 3 hours after sunset. Look higher in the sky to find Jupiter, which will shimmer above Orion. The Lyrid Meteor Shower Peak. The annual Lyrid Meteor Shower runs from April 14th to 30th. With peak conditions overnight, April 21st and 22nd, producing around 10 to 15 streaking meteors per hour under dark skies. The moon will set before midnight during the peak, ensuring those dark skies when the shower climbs highest in the pre-dawn hours. And finally, the Whirlpool Galaxy, which occurs all month. The galaxy season gives us the chance to view our interstellar neighbors, including some you can spy with binoculars. One of the best ones to see this month is the Whirlpool Galaxy, M51. It's high in the sky around midnight for most of the month, and its position near the handle of the Big Dipper makes it easy to locate. But the spiral galaxy is only going to appear as a smudge of light in binoculars. But it is quite bright with a noticeable spiral structure. So when viewed through a telescope, it's amazing. The Leo triplet of galaxies is also worth spotting this month. Look for it near the constellation Leo. And as always, it's always best to watch from an elevated stargazing site with little to no light pollution.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100 or WDIY.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, your ears will be perking up because we're going to help you take care of Japanese and Asiatic and June beetle damage. Your lawn's going to be saved. Your roses and fruit plants are going to be saved. It's a miracle. And it'll be coming up after these wonderful phone calls. Number to call, 610-694-8100. Steve, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Yep, I'm calling from Central Connecticut.
Okay. Can you be more specific?
Hartford.
Oh, I had a great time in Hartford. Was it just last year that I appeared there at the flower show?
Sounds right. I've been there a couple times.
Yeah. Oh, what a great reception we got there. And what a nice show. You're lucky to have it. So what can we do for Steve in Hartford?
Okay. I have a dwarf Rainier cherry tree.
Mm-hmm.
It's in a sunny location, full sun. Rob Ross would call it a happy tree. It's about 25 years old. It's
excellent.
About 15 feet wide.
Right.
And about I keep it about 10 feet tall. All branches can be reached from the ground. There's nothing crossing. It's open air, sunny center.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no visible damage or insects visible.
Right.
There's no leaf curl. There's no leaves discolored or falling off. There's no bark damage. Doesn't seem to be any sap leaking. All right?
Okay. So why are you calling?
I just want to gloat.
Yeah, gloat away, man.
I prune it midwinter or shortly after bloom or after harvest.
Bingo. Don't do door number three. Pruning in midwinter is ideal.
Okay.
Not especially. I think they're even. Pruning after the blooms are faded in the spring is also ideal, and you get to see more flowers. And
right.
I haven't said this in a while, but when you do prune a tree or shrub after it blooms,
you can start the pruning right away as soon as the flowers open. Bring them inside, have vases of clean, non-city tap water ready, cut another inch off the bottom of the stem, and you'll have indoor flowers that nobody else is going to have in their home. You know, the flowers of fruit trees are just drop-dead gorgeous.
And very fragrant.
Yeah, I like that idea. Don't prune in the fall because you'll be out there pruning maybe on a nice day, maybe not. But you have no idea what the temperature is going to do over the next 6 weeks. Pruning stimulates growth. So you prune, new growth emerges, and then, of course, it's going to go down to 20 degrees, and the sap in that new growth will freeze, and you'll have damaged the health of the tree. So people prune in the fall because they are bored, totally bored. Watch more football. I don't care what you do, but dead of winter or early spring are perfect. Fall pruning is dangerous.
When I do prune, I like to get the branches that are thin enough to snap off and the larger ones get cut. Is there really a difference there?
Well, I can only tell you that trees that send up suckers from the ground, if you want to stop those suckers, you snap them off. On the tree, I would prefer you cut them off because snapping could always cause some bark to be attached and torn off. And since you've been successful so far, I'll just say this for the sake of other people. When you do cut off a branch, you want to make the cut close to the tree, but making sure that portion of the tree that supports the limb that is outside the bark remains on the tree. You never want to cut so deep you expose or damage any kind of bark. And a cautionary tale, if the limb you're about to cut is pretty long and heavy, do it in sections.
Yes.
Otherwise, many bad things can happen.
Okay, well, here's my dilemma.
Okay.
I picked about 1,000 cherries.
Oh, you're still bragging now.
I know, but the next part is the disaster. And I did count them because I had a wheelbarrow there. I only netted 2 usable cherries that year.
What?
Everything else was either bruised, mummied, or had bird pecks in it. Not so much on the birds, but bruised and mummified.
Did you...
anything special?
Well, mummified would indicate to me that the tree was producing too much fruit, and it didn't have the energy to help the mummies grow. Normally, I've only talked about thinning apples and peaches early in the season, which is absolutely necessary. But if the tree is overloaded with fruit, I think picking off some of them and composting them when they're very young would stop the mummification. What you want to do is, you know, you're thinning the tree for airflow, will thin the fruits for airflow as well. If they're touching, get rid of one of them. If there's 18 fruits on a limb, seriously, maybe get rid of not so much half of them, but let's say a dozen.
The clusters or individual from each cluster?
Well, how many berries on a cluster for you?
I don't remember.
Vaguely.
I might say 4, maybe 6.
Yes, that's exactly where you would do your thinning. I would take the 4 down to 2 and the 6 down to 3 only because of what you experienced. But you seem to be implying this only happened last year.
It seems to be, yeah. I don't recall it being this serious of a problem. Could it be watering?
For a tree that size, watering is generally not a serious problem. Did you have the long droughts we had in Pennsylvania?
I don't remember. I'm not that close to tracking the weather.
Ah, thank God there's somebody else who doesn't remember anything. Who is this, by the way? No. If we have really high temperatures, you know, kissing 100 especially, you should deeply water your plants once a week by turning a hose on to drip and just letting that drip at the base of the tree for a solid 8 hours. I actually prefer 24, and then move the hose over to the next tree and yada, yada, yada. So every tree will get an inch of water a week. And obviously, if it rains an inch or more in a given week, you kind of start over. You got your inch, so you wait until it's been 7 days, and then you start watering again.
It would be nice if the online weather forecasters estimated the amount of water that fell in the past week, so I could keep track of that.
That's an easy problem, man. Just go to any garden center and buy a rain gauge. They can be a gardener's best friend.
Yeah, I used to have one of those digital units.
Oh, forget it. All you need is a plastic tube that rotates. You make a vow to check it every Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock, and you empty it out and you record how much was in it. Then you'll never be guessing.
And I've got a hypothesis.
Yeah?
These cherries are yellow with a red blush.
Yes.
I believe that the birds and evil squirrels, of course, want to wait until the cherries turn red. Therefore, I get more cherries.
Right.
They're not eating them as much. I think they see them as yellow and they want to wait.
Well, have you tasted a yellow one?
Oh, yeah. That's the prime. That's in their best. You see them in the store that way.
So if you harvest early, you prevent bird and evil squirrel attacks.
Right. I might even prevent some of the bruising.
Absolutely. Whether it's tomatoes, cherries, peaches, apples, the sooner you can correctly harvest them, the less they're out in the open and the less they're exposed to bad things happening.
That's right. And in reference to forgetting things,
yeah,
are your arms getting shorter too?
Are my arms getting shorter? No, but my body is. I'm losing height, which for somebody who used to be 6 foot is awful. All right, Steve, good luck. And I think you've already figured out a lot of what you need. Eliminate that fall pruning, and I predict cherry pie in your future.
I even make my own crusts.
Oh, excellent. I'll be over. All right, you take care, man.
Very good. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I am on track to appear at the Allentown Public Library on Monday, April 27th at 6 p.m. And not any of those other dates I've been tossing out there. Sorry about that. Visit allentownpl.org for all the details and to pre-register. And then come right back to hear the right ways to beat the Beatles and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the NPR studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA.
Do you have vinyl albums, 45s, or CDs on your shelves that are taking up space and gathering dust? Why not donate them for a good cause? WDIY will receive profits from the donation, and you can claim a tax deduction. For more information, or to arrange for a drop-off or pickup, call 610-694-8100 or visit WDIY.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we're going to help you take care of Japanese and Asiatic and June beetle damage from birth to death. And it'll be coming up right after these wonderful phone calls to 610-694-8100, extension number 3.
Hi, this is Nancy in Edmond, Oklahoma. I'm calling about a question for a multi-limbed fig tree, a little Violetta de Bordeaux fig tree we've had 6 or 8 years. It's been fully neglected except to keep watered, and it comes up nicely every year, and it's got about 50 straight stalks that come up from the ground and make a fig bush, I guess. We've never gotten any figs, and I'd like to take care of it now. Hopefully we can do something better with it. I'd like to know how I could trim it so that it could want to make figs, and also if the trimmings can be made into other little fig trees. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, it's great to hear from our listeners in the greater OKC area. And your question is not uncommon. And I have a complete answer for you that'll have you full of figs, but it may not happen this year. What you're going to do throughout this year will give you a bumper crop of figs. And depending on the weather and the variety, you might get two crops. Isn't that nice? So here's the story. Figs are very tough. They are Mediterranean plants, and they have no sense of humor about winter. So in almost all cases, well, I shouldn't say almost all cases, in cold climes, they will almost always lose all their top growth. But you can't kill the roots. You could try, but you would not be able to. Which means when the fig regrows from the roots in the spring, you have a tiny little fig plant, even if it's 50 years old, because it's starting fresh. The idea is to preserve a lot of greenery at the end of the season, keep it from freezing, and then you'll hit the ground running in the spring with a full-size fig tree. And don't feel bad in this case. Almost everybody gets figs wrong. So by now, your roots have sent out the new greenery for this year. Look at it carefully and cut off anything that seems dead, diseased, but otherwise just let it grow. I know you were concentrating on watering, but you're in Oklahoma, so I have nothing to say about that. You probably need to be doing it. And then throughout the year, all you got to do is largely ignore it. Figs are very easy to grow if you get the sequence down. You may even get some figs at the very end of the season. And heartbreakingly, this often occurs just as frost is coming and the little figs don't get to ripen up, which is an ultimate boo-hoo. That's not fair. And it's not. But what you're going to do as cold weather approaches. Now, this is interesting. Figs don't need to be protected from like Halloween to Easter. It's really just those really cold months, like January and February, that they're most prone to being frozen. So the easiest thing to do, especially if the fig is in a somewhat protected location, best place to grow a fig is next to a building or a wall where it gets southeastern sun. So this is nothing you have to rush on, But as we get into November, maybe even early December, you want to have in hand floating row covers. Now, you've seen these things all over the place. They're spun polyester and they grow underneath the vast majority of lettuces in California. Not so much for frost protection, but it keeps bugs physically off the lettuce. You're going to use it like a bandage or a blanket. You're going to wrap the tree with spun polyester fabric. One big brand name is Rheem-A. If they don't know what you're talking about when you say row covers, say Rheem-A and they'll know what you mean. It's like Tylenol. You want to cover it all the way to the top. And sources differ on this. I would not go crazy at the top. I mean, some people build a home for their figs and cover the top with a 5-gallon bucket. But all you got to do is cover the thing beginning at the ground and as high up as you can go. And when you get to the top, just pull the Rheem-A over the top. But don't go crazy because they need to be protected from extreme weather, but they need to breathe. And fabric row covers provide that. Now, some people go to all sorts of extremes, and I'll probably talk about those later in the season. But really, that's all you have to do. Before it gets nasty cold, wrap them in Rheem-A, spun polyester, row covers, whatever they call it. And if you go to a hip garden center, they'll have different levels. And you want the winter level. They make a much lighter Rheem-A in the spring because, you know, you don't want the air to heat up around your lettuces or something. But in the winter, you want the heavy duty protection. And then all you need to do is nothing. A gardener's best friend is doing nothing. And then when the weather warms up in the spring and you don't see any treacherous numbers in the 10-day forecast, and it's at a reasonable time in the season, like not the 80-day degrees we had in January, as soon as it seems safe, take off that Rheem-A. Now you'll see that the fig is already actively growing, but it has all of those first-year branches left alive. If any didn't make it, just prune them off. You know, dry spells, certainly water it. Don't feed it. You don't want to encourage it. And yes, if you prune a very healthy branch off a fig tree and plant it in the ground, it will root. It roots better than any other plant in our gardens. But again, plant it in a protected area for extra insurance. And you are going to have figs you won't believe in.
This is Roy. I'm calling you from Normandy, Tennessee. I live in southeastern Tennessee, about halfway between Nashville and Chattanooga, on the edge of what is known in Tennessee as the Highland Rim, a steep escarpment of hills that lead ultimately up to the Cumberland Mountains in the east. The terrain that I'm discussing is fairly typical oak hickory forests, very dry, used to be covered with chestnut trees, but of course the blight came through here in 32 and killed them. I still have one growing out in my woods that comes back every year from the stump. Extremely dry climate here. There's almost no topsoil at all. And it is a nice forest, but not a lot else can grow in the soil. If I want to grow a flower, I have to import some humus. A few years ago, we moved up here from the central basin of Tennessee. As soon as we moved here on the hill, we began to not do anything to the woods. They had just been logged off. Part of not doing anything was to have a little trail going through the woods where we could walk the dog. Eventually, I started to notice the appearance of a few plants that I connected with deer. One of these plants was the pawpaw, which I felt like had to be getting here through the deer because the deer would bed down at the place where the pawpaw grew, and I assumed that the deer would rise in the morning and defecate out seeds. The question I had relates to another thing I started to notice, which was the jack in the pulpit would also come up in little clumps along the trail, and I began to wonder if deer and other animals eat things that are naturally astringent. I think you mentioned that the pawpaw seed was mildly toxic, as is the seed of arum plants. Am I right about this? Do we have the deer transferring plants like that? And are they eating the astringent for digestive purposes? Does it help them clean themselves out or something? I appreciate it. Thank you.
Roy, what a great voicemail. And if I wanted more information, I think I'd call the Tennessee Visitors Bureau, because you should be a guide in the woods there. Pawpaws, let's start with them. Pawpaws, I'm not sure when the seeds become toxic. Nobody eats pawpaw seeds. They are much like a watermelon. And when a pawpaw is ripe, and most of the time you'll find that out, is when it drops from the tree. Because even the ones that look the ripest, if they're still holding on, they are not ready yet. Pawpaw drop time is a great time to be hanging out around the trees. Pawpaws are not seen in supermarkets or very popular because they have a very short lifespan as an edible. You should pick up your pawpaw, take it back, and you would scoop the custard-like material out with a spoon, which there's no other flavor like it in the plant world. It's ambrosia. And then you would do your imitation of a deer from the other end. You spit out the seeds, just like with watermelon. Yes. The deer eating the dropped pawpaw will not spit out the seeds. That'd be cool. But they will pass the seeds through the digestive tract and replant that strain of pawpaw. It is quite likely that the deer eat the pawpaw and spit out the seeds because other herbivores might not be able to separate the seeds out, so they will not replant them. As to how can so many creatures eat things that we're not allowed to, it's because God made them that way. I mean, birds can exist the entire summer on hot peppers that would have us holding our face under the cold water faucet and begging for help. They just pass through. The birds are better off for it. It's great nutrition, warms them in the summer. And there's so many seeds in pawpaws. But again, think about this marvel of nature. The seeds are not ripe until the fruit drops. The tree, the pawpaw, does not want to be eaten before the seeds are fully ripe, because then it will have failed in its mission to propagate. So it's most likely that deer are living there because they're waiting for the pawpaw drop, and they love the custardy flavor. Deer have probably enjoyed many more pawpaws than humans have. and then they poop out what are definitely ripe seeds. It's a miracle. It's wonderful. And as to whether they get anything out of the seeds, you know, a little like something passing through the gut to clean it out, something like that, I don't believe so, because they've also evolved not to bite into the pellets. They just go down with the custard and they come out here. And yes, they are spreading the pawpaws. Jack in the Pulpit, I'm not certain. I don't think Jack needs to be eaten. To the best of my knowledge, all of those type plants, including the nasty one in Washington, D.C., that blooms like once every 5-10 years, but it smells terrible because it is pollinated by flies, filth flies. So the Jack in the Pulpit, which is a beautiful plant, I believe is pollinated and the seeds just drop off. I don't think anybody's eating, but again, I'm not looking anything up here. I'm just answering as if you were on the phone. But I love your story. Feel free to go back there again every day during drop season and bring a couple home. But the thing is, you got to eat them right away. They do not keep. They're tasteless like 2 days before they fall. So you got to be right around there. And you'll know where they are if you lose your way. Just look for all those deer pellets on the ground. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and reannounce that I will make a rare personal appearance at the Allentown Public Library on Monday, April 27th at 6 p.m. Visit allentownpl.org/events for all the details and to register for this free event. Then we'll be right back with the correct ways to beat the Beatles and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the NPR studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. Are you thinking of taking spring lawn care advice from a lunatic leprechaun on TV? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, I'll tell you what you should and shouldn't be doing to have healthy turf this summer, plus your fabulous phone calls. That's on the next You Bet Your Garden. Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and yes, cats and kittens, we are in the stretch. Pretty soon, I'll help you garrote your grubs. Anyway, but we're going to beat your beetles in the question of the week, which you will hear after. Something completely different. We have uncovered tapes of my original shows, and there's some great phone calls in there. So join us in this trip down memory lane.
Richard, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike.
Hello, Richard. How are you?
I'm fine.
And where are you fine, sir?
I'm fine in Lamar, Missouri, which is the birthplace of Harry Truman.
Oh, excellent. Well, what can we do for you in Missouri, Rich?
I have a problem with moles. They absolutely can devastate a lawn, and I've been the victim of them more often than I would like.
And you're sure it's moles? In other words, you have raised tunnels and no plant damage.
Yes, I have.
Okay.
That describes it very well.
that's fine, Rich, actually. That's the preferred vermin underground because you don't want voles, V-O-L-E-S. They make lots of little holes in your lawn, and they eat plant material underground like mad. Now, have you done anything to control the Japanese beetle grubs, or where you are, perhaps the June beetle or rose chafer grubs in your lawn?
No, I haven't. I probably need some advice on this.
Well, it depends. Moles, M-O-L-E-S, are carnivorous. They only eat meat. And their diet consists essentially of two things, earthworms or the grubs that turn into some sort of plant-eating beetle. If you had a huge number of grubs, you would most likely see brown patches on your lawn. And then if you pulled up that grass, especially in, say, the late spring or the late fall, you would see the actual squishy, crescent-shaped, white, nasty-looking guys underneath feeding on your lawn roots. And a lot of times that will cause moles to colonize your lawn because they're down there eating beetle grubs. And, you know, if you got enough moles, you might never see the grub damage. I would urge you to invest in milky spore disease if Japanese beetle grubs are endemic in your area. You know, milky spore is a naturally occurring soil bacterium. You just put it on your lawn in a checkerboard pattern once, and then those things colonize your lawn, and the grubs can't live there anymore after a couple of years, so moles don't come into the area as often. Now, if your moles are after earthworms, that's going to be a different story. I can tell you right away that pinwheels don't work, those sonic vibrators don't work.
I'll attest to that.
But what does work against moles is castor oil. You've probably heard the old story, plant a castor bean plant in your garden and it'll keep moles away. Well, it really won't, but they won't go anywhere near that plant because there's something about the smell, especially when the beans, those poisonous beans, fall off the plant. You know, it's a big, beautiful, lush-looking tropical plant. They look great. But they also have a strong smell that absolutely repels moles. So rather than go to all that trouble, there are a huge number of products out there that are castor oil based. You can also try a homemade version. Very low tech, Richard.
Okay.
Just get a bottle of castor oil. You want to, you know, the kind of stuff that your grandmother gave you because
she
said it was good for you, but she was really mad.
Right.
And I think it's 2 ounces or a quarter cup into just the sprinkling can. And then fill the sprinkling can about halfway to three-quarter way with some lukewarm water and add a couple of drops of dishwashing soap and a couple of drops of vegetable oil and walk around your lawn where you see the tunnels and water this stuff in good when the ground is bone dry. This stuff makes the moles crazy and they will go colonize your neighbor's lawns.
I'll certainly take your advice.
All right, Richard. You have a good summer down there now.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
As promised, it is indeed time for a very special question of the week, which we are calling Beat the Beetles. Lawn owners, do not treat your turf with anything now. The grubs that turn into emerging adult beetles do not feed as they rise up from your lawn in the spring, and they must ingest the all-natural products that are effective against them in the late summer, early fall. Exception: beneficial nematodes, especially species that are labeled as exceptionally good for grub control. These miniature marvels don't depend on the beetle ingesting anything. Ha ha, they ingest the beetle. They're sold by the millions in surprisingly small pouches. Look for a good sell-by or use-by date, as they are alive. Alive! No, you just drop that sponge containing the nematodes into clean, not tap water. It's got to be filtered, spring water, whatever. but not the stuff that comes out of your pipes, especially if you're anywhere in or near a city. And then use that clean water to water them into your pre-saturated turf. Wet it down good, just as the sun is setting, not in the morning or daytime. At this time of year, your best course of action is to buy a single pheromone trap. You see them all over the place, and place it in the middle of the area that is normally attacked and put it out in June. Check it daily. And when you see the very first beetle inside, drown that pest in soapy water, fold up the trap, seal it in two Ziplocs, and store it in the basement for reuse next year. This is called monitoring, and its only job is to tell you when the first beetles emerge, not to try and catch them all. Why? Because if you leave beetle traps up, they will attract four times as many beetles than usual, but they're only going to capture less than half of them, which increases the potential danger to your plants. When you do see that first beetle, be ready and begin spraying the plants they normally attack with a liquid solution of BTG, the newest strain of BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, in town. All right, I know we got to do the history. The original BT was released around 100 years ago. Technically, its name is BTK for Kerstaki, but most people just call it BT. Sprayed on plant leaves, it causes the gut of destructive caterpillars munching on that plant to immediately stop working and die. Widely available under a variety of brand names, old school farmers often just call it Dipel. The next strain that was found to be useful was BTI for Israeliensis, as it was discovered in Israel. This strain of BT only affects mosquitoes, specifically the eggs and larvae of mosquitoes that are developing in standing water. Add BTI dunks or granules to that water, and they can't finish the process and die before they can bite anybody. There are many strains of BT, thousands, constantly being tested, and the latest one to have superpowers is BTG. G standing for Galleria. It is an excellent organic control against beetle grubs and adults, which is unusual and maybe unique. It is slowly becoming available under more brand names. Spray that BTG on plants as soon as you capture or see the first beetle of the season, and the beetles that follow will soon die after they eat the sprayed leaves. Respray after rain. And just so a couple thousand of you don't call or email to ask if any of the BTs hurt children, pets, bees, birds, beneficial insects, and the like, the answer is no. The original BT only affects caterpillars that eat the leaves of sprayed plants. So don't spray your parsley, which is the host plant of a great-looking butterfly. BTI only affects mosquito eggs and larvae breeding in standing water. Nothing else, okay? Your dog can drink it. Your kids can play in it. Birds and butterflies can drink from it. BTG only affects beetles in the scarab family, like Japanese beetles, Asiatic beetles, and June beetles, aka June bugs, when they feed. Now, when the adult beetles are done feeding for the season and disappear, you can apply those nematodes, granular BTI, or milky spore disease to your turf. This is the time, not now. Grubs at this stage are ravenous and will ingest the BTI or milky spore granules as they fatten up on the roots of your lawn while preparing to survive the winter. This is the only time of year, late summer, early fall, to apply grub-killing materials to your turf. Again, other than nematodes, which you will remember, eat the beetle grubs. Other tips. Some species, especially the Asiatic beetle, are nocturnal and attracted to artificial light, leading them to swarm around homes, porches, and even come into buildings during summer nights. Asiatic beetles damage your plants unseen, just like slugs. If you see, quote, Japanese beetle damage on your plants, but you don't see no beetles during the day, spray the plants right before bedtime. All of the plant munching beetles are also consumed by a variety of birds, beneficial insects, and small mammals, with starlings, robins, and cardinals acting as primary predators. Chickens love them. They will peck them off your plants, or if you vacuum them off your plants and empty it near your chickens, they will consume every one, and you'll get better eggs from it too. P.S. If you see birds pecking at your lawn or raccoon damage in late summer, break out the BTG. And finally, I can't resist sharing this bug juice home remedy, which I was reminded of while researching this article. Quote, this is gross, but my neighbor told me to pick the beetles off by hand, mix them up in a second-hand blender with some water, strain out the big bits, put the rest in a spray bottle, and spray your affected plants, reapplying when it rains. I haven't done this myself, but his landscape looks a lot better than mine. Well, that sure was some great information about fighting all kinds of beetles and grubs. Now, wasn't it? Luckily, you can read those details over at your leisure, or of course your leisure, by following the link for the Gardens Alive question of the week at the top of the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Yikes, my producer is threatening to hide my BTG. If I don't get out of this studio, whew, we must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100 and follow the prompts. Or send us your email. You're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse, teeming towards our garden shore at youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. Whether you call us, whether you email us, whether you tape a letter to the front door, please include your location. You'll find all of our contact information, plus answers to your garden questions, audio of this show, audio of recent shows, and links to our internationally renowned podcast at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is an hour-long public radio show and podcast, all produced and delivered to you week by NPR station WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when he saw the Three Stooges perform live at a nightclub in 1960. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Northley. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Zipro. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jones Bowen, and our incredible assistant is the awesome Ninja Sean. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'll keep denying the actual weather and plant peas, lettuces, and potatoes until I see you again next week.